We are starting the Mystic Pete Chronicles, and I'm Mystic Pete. Every week, through interviews with thought leaders, visionaries, and creatives, and stories, music, and humor, we'll do some deep ponders in this time of great change, and have some fun. If you'd like more information about today's guests, or to be interviewed for the show yourself, I'm at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interview Laura Stegman talking about the writer's process and her book, Summer of Luck. We start the show with a tune by Andrei Vinogradov on Hurdy-Gurdy called Equilibrium, and end the show with a tune by Opium Moon, Women, Life, Freedom. Stay tuned! Thank you. March 15th, 2023, Mystic Pete here with Laura Stegman, who just came out with a book called Summer of Luck, and that's spelled L-U-C-K with periods between each letter. Hi, Laura.
Hi, Pete. Nice to see you.
We've worked together before, and I know you mostly as a publicist, but you're a writer too and very involved in literature and these genres. Why don't you tell us about yourself and how you are involved in the community, and then we'll get to your book itself.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, first of all, thank you for having me. And I have been a publicist most of my working life, and I've worked with arts organizations and classical music, theater, different kinds of things that fall under the category of arts. And I've always been a writer in that work, and I've always written press releases and biographies, and I did some freelance writing also earlier in my career. And I would say of all the work that I do, writing is my favorite part of it. Writing a pitch letter, telling someone a story, trying to get them interested in doing a feature or something on a client. That's what a publicist does, for anyone who doesn't know that. And
you kind of got into it through writing, or at least that's a big part of the job, writing.
Yeah, and I'm not formally trained in writing, but my parents were both, they were both publicists, and they also were big readers, and they encouraged me to read from a very young age. So I've always been a reader. And when I was a kid, I read all middle grade books for 8 to 12 type thing. And when I got a little older, I started reading, you know, books for teens, young adults. You know, I continue to read through my life. Telling a story, as I said, is something I've never formally studied, but I've always enjoyed doing it in my work. And when I've gotten, like, I have it, let's say I have an interesting client or they're doing something interesting. Well, telling the media the story, not of what the play's about, but of what's behind the play, what might make an interesting article. That's telling the story. And that's where I think I've just done it so much over the years that I've gotten practice. And about 20 years ago, going back, I mean, I've been in my field for quite some time, decades. And but 20 years ago, I decided that I had been doing some writing work with a friend who was a songwriter, and I did a website for him, and I did a road diary when he went out on the road with his band. And I thought it was so much fun that I said, you know, to myself, I want to write a book for kids. I don't know why I thought that. It's just that I loved the books that I read when I was growing up, and I still read some of them. Or at the time, I was still reading some of them. I still do. And I thought that it would be really fun to write a book for kids that would make me feel the way those books did. There was a couple of books in particular that had sort of magical fantasy, but they were grounded in reality, and they were about kids who were struggling with one thing or another. And, you know, when I read books about kids who didn't like the way they looked or were embarrassed about their freckles, because I have freckles, and when I was a kid, I had tons of freckles, and they were very noticeable. I didn't know anyone else who had freckles. And I used to get teased about my freckles.
People would make fun of you.
Yeah.
And perhaps reading a story that puts it in context or makes you feel a little better may help you deal with the situation.
There was a book that I read about a girl who had freckles, and she didn't like her freckles any more than I did.
Interesting.
And
okay.
So I remember this story had, it was called The Diamond in the Window, this book, and it's still read by kids today. And it was about these kids who live in Concord, Massachusetts, and they live in this big magical house, and they go on these adventures. And one of the adventures, the girl has two choices. One is a mirror where she can see how she looks in the future. Well, they're both mirrors, and she gets to choose which one does she want. One, she can't see her freckles as much, so she takes that mirror journey, and she grows up in the mirror and she sees that she doesn't like the woman that she becomes. She's very pinched, and she's, you know, and so she fights her way back out and she goes in the other mirror where she can see her freckles, and she's surrounded, you know, this book was written in the 60s, so she's a mother. That was her dream, you know, to have be a mom with kids, and she looked really happy. And so I just thought, you know, she accepted herself with her freckles, and I never forgot how that made me feel. Like I could be okay with my freckles or whatever. And so when I thought about writing a book, I just thought, wow, you know, I want to write a book that would maybe make some kid today feel better about something that they don't like about themselves. And that was how I came up with the idea for Summer of Luck, which is nothing like the book I just told you about, but it has elements, and it was inspired by that book. So so I started to write Summer of Luck, and I realized after I'd written a whole first draft, which I thought was fantastic, you know, and it maybe it was, but it wasn't good enough to be published. And I realized I didn't know enough about writing fiction. I was really good at writing a pitch letter, a press release, a bio. I could do that, but I didn't know anything about writing fiction. So I spent the next, well, I mentioned that I started this book in early 2000s, and I really spent about 18 years, you know, learning to write better and revising it and telling the story and improving it. I had a lot of adult things in the book that, I mean, not adult things like scary or dangerous, but, you know, things that no kid would be interested in. I had to be sort of redirected to telling the story from the kid's point of view. It didn't really matter what the adults did in the book. So I did that through working with a development editor. And so, you know, I said I didn't study creative writing, but I really did when it comes down to it, when you look at what I did over the course of writing Summer of Luck, because I worked with a development editor and he helped me understand about points of view and sentence. I don't think I ever was a poor writer. I just needed to tell the story better. And that's what I learned to do over the years. And then I started working with other writers and trading stories with them and seeing what they were writing, and they would, you know, we would give each other input, and that was really, really helpful. So I finally, you know, got Summer of Luck to a place where when I would submit to agents, which I had started doing immediately, which was a big mistake, I was getting requests, you know, I was getting interest. I wasn't getting silence or no thank you. In 2000, it was right before the pandemic, 2019, I got a yes from a publisher, and that publisher published the first edition of Summer of Luck. This is the second. And, you know, it was a dream come true. Had a different cover. Everything in the book is the same as this edition, second edition. But unfortunately, so that was like my dream come true. The second edition of Summer of Luck came out just recently with a new cover and illustrations inside the book and a map of the summer camp where it takes place. And so that's the story of my journey as a writer.
One of the main themes in Summer of Luck is children, young adults, finding their voice, both literally and figuratively. And I just want to point out that through the writing of this book, well, you've perhaps found some of your voice too. So
indeed.
There we go.
Indeed. And that was the gist of writing, you know, of the story of Summer of Luck. You know, I wanted to write a book about kids finding their voices. And the characters in the book, the main characters, are all of them struggle with talking in some way. Darby, who's 11, she stutters, and she's embarrassed about her stutter. And her mom is very critical of her stuttering, and that, of course, makes everything worse. And Justin, who's 12, his father just died sometime before the book started. And he's so full of grief that he just shuts down and isn't talking at all. And the third character, Naz, who's 10, comes from Morocco, and he speaks Arabic and French, but he's just learning English. So they all sort of have their issues. And when they meet at summer camp, they are struck with this magical calliope music, which is like the music from a carousel. And all of a sudden, they can hear each other's thoughts. And it doesn't matter what language they're speaking, and they can hear. When they want to send a thought, the other person can hear it. And they are pretty blown away by that, because...
A little telepathy there. Yeah. Okay, Mystic Pete, we're happy with that stuff.
Well, exactly. And, you know, I've always loved that kind of magic. Like, I'm not into, like, high fantasy or deep science fiction or that kind of thing, but I love the idea that there's another level of being, you know, that we don't know what it is.
Really?
But it's
there, okay, yeah. Okay, good. Good to know.
And so... that's the premise of Summer of Luck, that these three kids meet, they can connect because they don't have to talk to each other. I mean, they end up, of course, at a certain point actually talking, but the fact that they meet and they connect with each other brings each one of them out of the shell that each one is in. And Naz, you know, who sort of stumbles through his sentences and gets a wrong word in here and there, but nobody minds. These three kids support each other. And when Darby stutters, you know, she may be embarrassed, but she doesn't, you know, nobody makes fun of her. And so they discover that this magical music is coming from an abandoned warehouse next to their summer camp. And so what else do kids do in a kid's book is they sneak away and they want to find out what's making this music. And so they sneak into this warehouse one night. They all sneak off, and it turns out it's an abandoned warehouse. But it turns out when they go there, it's a magical carnival. And this calliope music is being sent to them by this man who has had passed away a few years before. So he's not at rest, and he sort of sent for these kids because he has a task for them. They learn that his family, his adult children, are fighting and estranged over this property, and what he wants is he wants the camp to own his property so kids can play there forever. And his kids, his oldest son especially, wants to sell it to a developer and tear it down. So he tells the kids, if you help, I'd like you to help me repair this relationship between my kids. And if you can, I will, or as you do, I will help you kids find your voices. And that is sort of the premise of Summer of Luck. And the ghost's name is Leroy Usher, and his title is Carnival King, because he was the head of this. He used to build carnival rides and games. And if you figure L, Leroy, U, Usher, C for carnival, K for king. So that's
Summer of L-U-C-K. And right. As I say, there's a period between each letter, L-U-C-K. That's the title of the book.
Right.
Summer of Luck.
Right. And so the kids are really interested and anxious to help Mr. Usher. They find him... delightful and not scary. He appears to be a human being. He appears in human form in the book. He's not like a sphere or anything like that. They actually see him, and they find out that all he wants to do is go back to rest and be with his wife. But he can't do that until he knows that this property is going to be in safe hands. And it just so happens that the kids, you know, in sort of this magical way in middle grade books, they each resemble what Mr. Usher's kids used to look like when they were kids. So when when the kids have their adventures at the carnival, and they get to go on all these fun carnival rides and eat cotton candy and, you know, do the kinds of things you would do at a regular carnival, they will be appear to the adult children as memories of their of themselves as kids and remind them of the great times they had. And, you know, the story is how the kids and how Mr. Usher weave their adventures, showing his adult children what it was like to have those adventures themselves. Meanwhile, Mr. Usher is showing Darby how to, you know, I don't want to spoil the ending, but each showing each of the kids how to develop confidence in themselves and believe in themselves and come to a place where when they leave camp, they're very different kids from when they got there. So that's basically the overall gist. But as you say, you know, it is a story about kids finding their way to self-acceptance, finding their voices with the help of this ghost who haunts this magical carnival.
I think a kind of amnesia sets in somewhere in teenage times so that adults don't really remember how hard it is to be a kid when there's something different about you, or even if you are the same. Like, children can be merciless and bully each other terribly, and kids can get bullied by parents and adults or teachers, like severe cruelty. Mm-hmm. To, I mean, most kids come through this, not all of them, but I certainly did. And it was brutal, actually. It was traumatizing, but we forget about that and then can recreate that condition for our kids or for kids we're responsible for as teachers or something like that. So we forget how hard it is to be a little different, to have freckles, to, you know, if you have a stutter or you can't, you don't know English well, you get picked on. It's just horrible.
Yeah.
And I do think that through literature or movies or the arts, kids can find something to touch, something to reassure them and encourage them and help them get through all this cruelty, which really shouldn't be happening at all.
Right.
But
it does.
Until we resolve our civilization and we all become kind, compassionate beings, which could happen at any moment or any century. You know, literature is very important. And even just for the fact of having a refuge. I mean, I just remember my I'd never read a book 7 or 8 years old, and I thought, oh, I can't really read a book. And a librarian told me, well, take a look at this. It was called The Sword in the Stone. I still remember it. I don't think anybody's heard of this, but I was so engaged, and it was so magical, and it just transported me. And then, of course, we all know how, you know, Harry Potter is for young people and adults, or Tolkien, or this and that. And it takes us away for a minute and gives us a window into an enchanted reality so we can just take a break from this grinding one for a minute. Interesting conclusion to the book. Now I'll talk about game theory. So in game theory, there's something called zero-sum game, where one person wins at the expense of somebody else. So the more one person succeeds, somebody else has to lose. Well, I mean, we see that in sports. Like, one person wins the game and one person loses. That's just the way it is. Or presidential campaigns. One person is going to be president and one person is going to lose. Although that's been disputed in recent elections by a one loser. But theoretically, this is a zero-sum game. And it looks like that is going to be happening in Summer of Luck. But I really like how you found a creative solution. So, you know, people were creative in the book, and instead of taking the most selfish, defensive, money-making options, they came up with new solutions that ended up just feeling better and kind of, you know, a win-win situation, so to speak. And so I think, in that, there's a nice message for anybody or adults that, you know, we don't always have to take the most self-involved course. It just seems like that's just the way we're taught to think. What's the most safest? What's the most defensive? How can I make the most money? And if everybody on the planet is doing that, well, you get a kind of a pretty crummy Earth. But just like if everyone just slows down, what are some other options here? Let's be creative. Let's think. How can we be kind here? You know, like if that happened today, tomorrow we'd have a much nicer world. Yeah. So anyway, a beautiful message in your book, and that probably anybody would enjoy reading it.
Thank you. A lot of my life experience goes into this book. And the other thing I wanted to say about that is that even though there is magic in the book, the ghost doesn't wave a magic wand and the kids are better. You know, they really learn in real life situations. And they, you know, Darby learns a lot about her mom that she had no idea was the case. And not that it makes her mom any better, but it makes Darby understand more. And they find solutions to their issues and their problems without, as you say, having to hurt anybody or have anybody else have to lose. And the other thing that I also wanted to say about kids literature for kids, kid lit for short, is that today, and I would say, you know, probably in the last 5 to 10 years, and certainly as we go forward, the availability of books for kids who struggle with reading is so much broader and wider than it was when I was growing up. For example, when I was growing up and I didn't really want to read comic books, but I remember my parents would be like, you can't read comic books. They're not literature. And today there's graphic novels. So the kids who do struggle with words on a page can actually have the words in pictures. And those books are very sophisticated literature. And then there's books about whatever kind of situation a kid could be going through. I mean, books that we wouldn't have dreamed of when I was a kid, especially growing up in a very, you know, middle class neighborhood that was very much where everybody looked the same, you know. Today, not everybody looks the same, and there's kids that have never seen themselves in a book. Maybe there's certainly a different ethnicity than white, you know. There are books for kids with any kind of experience that you can imagine. I read a book about a girl who has autism. And one of the things that was fascinating to me about reading that book was that I understood from the character's point of view what it was like to, you know, hear, in this particular case, this girl couldn't deal with loud noises or crowds, and she had to find a ways around that and still be able to be among people. And I read a book about a girl who has OCD. And again, you know, I would never imagine a book like that when I was growing up. But if a kid has OCD today and they read this book, I mean, I know I wouldn't have felt so alone if I read a book like that.
Exactly.
There's books for kids in the LGBTQ community. And I read one recently and I wasn't really crazy about it until the end, when I realized that what that book was saying was, you know, it's hard coming out, especially at that age. And you got to find your community. You got to find other kids that are going through what you're going through, however you do it. And there's, what's that expression? It gets better. It gets better.
And there's so many areas that children need to refer to. Children of color, children going through divorce,
immigration, kids who come from other countries.
Death and dying.
Yes.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah, yeah. There are so many books. And bullying, as you mentioned, you know, there are just thousands of books today that if a family doesn't know where to find books like that, go to a library. Talk to a librarian. And, you know, and or talk to a friendly teacher. You know, there's a lot of help for kids struggling today. And if they can't find it at home, you know, try to find it at school or that kind of thing. So, you know, and books will help kids understand they're not alone. And they don't have to worry if they're different.
If we don't ban the books that talk about that stuff.
Well, that's a whole other
I mean, but it's subject. A very current, it's intense yeah. issue that's yes. really a problem.
It's a big problem.
We don't have to get into that, but, you know, half the country right now, they're yanking books off the shelves of the libraries.
Yeah, that's true. Very true. Some of the authors I just mentioned have had that happen to their books.
It's shocking. Books. Like, what are we in Germany in the 1930s or something? No, here we are, United States, yeah. 2023.
Yeah. But there's also a counter movement to that, too. I mean, you know, there are a lot of brave librarians who are making sure kids and teachers and educators who are making sure that kids do have access to books.
You can get fired. Before we move on to the next point, I just wanted to mention that I'm an avid reader. Every day I read the Times, for instance. But as a kid, I couldn't understand why my parents are reading the newspaper every day. But I started reading the comics section. And it was comics that got me into reading. Just reading, you know, Charlie Brown every day or whatever. And that turned me into a reader. So I'm all for graphic novels and comics as a way in. Like, we'll take it. Any way in, do it. But let's talk a little about youth literature now. I know you're involved in that community beyond your own writing. Can you explain, like, we use the word middle grade. I always thought of it as YA youth, young adult literature. Give us a little education.
Sure. Well, there's all kinds of literature for kids. For the younger kids, there's picture books. And then after picture books, you get a little older and you probably 6, 7, you can start with chapter books, which are very simply written, but interesting stories for kids that are like 6 and 7, just starting to read books that don't have pictures. And then after that is middle grade literature, which is for 7 to 12, basically, or even 13. And those are books like Summer of Luck, about kids who are those ages and who are starting to discover themselves, who are starting to find out and figure out who they are and how they may or may not like themselves and make and have friends. They have, you know, there's a lot of stories about friendships and best friends fighting and best friends splitting apart and coming back together again. And kids who are struggling with family issues and all kinds of things. And then once a kid is 12 or 13, they might start reading young adult books, where when I say that those are the ages for those books, it's mostly middle grade books have characters that are 10 to 12, but they're for a wider age range. And then when you start having characters that are 13 at the youngest, but 14 and up, those are for middle grade.
YA, young adult. Yeah. And then, so Harry Potter would be in that.
Well, the way that those books were written were brilliant, because the first book, I forgot the name of it, The Sorcerer's Stone or something like that, that's written for middle graders. That is when Harry Potter is whatever age he starts at. I mean, he was pretty young, like 10 or 11, something like that. And as the books go on, there's 7 books. By the time the last book comes around, you know, he's what, I don't remember the exact age, but he's much older, because 4 or 5 years have passed. So, the first book is certainly for older middle graders, you know, probably 10 and up. And then, books that are for young adults that fall in that category is where you start seeing a little more romance than you probably wouldn't see much about romance in a middle grade book. You might have a girl and a boy who like each other, but not deep and heavy. When you get into the young adults, it's when their bodies are changing, their personalities are changing, you know, they're teenagers. And there's books, I'm not very familiar with today's young adult books. I don't usually read in that genre. But I do remember when I was growing up, you know, books where I remember a story about a girl who couldn't afford a cashmere sweater and all her friends could. And, you know, that was sort of a very 1960s concept about whatever a teenager was struggling with. But there was also a book, I'd never seen one before, who's about a girl who struggled with overeating, which was a problem that I had and I struggled with. And I was very embarrassed about my size and my, you know, my body and how I looked. And there was this one book. Today, I'm not going to say hundreds, but there are a lot of books for kids who are struggling with eating disorders of one kind or another and body image. And when I read those books today, I just think to myself, wow, I wish this book existed.
Thank goodness those resources are around now.
Yeah. So young adult books are a lot more sophisticated in terms of what the kids are going through and sometimes very difficult subjects, but you know, that's important for kids to see what when someone struggles with something, how do you deal with it?
At that age, they want to read about romance and sexuality, and if it's a little too bland, they won't stick with it. So it has to be a little more sophisticated.
Exactly.
And The Hobbit, then, I think I read it at 13 or 14, very engaged, very age appropriate for me. What would you call that? Because adults read that book, no problem.
Yeah, there's a lot of books like Harry Potter series, which really cross in, you know, from young adult to adult, or, you know, anybody can read them. And I would say The Hobbit, The Lord of the Rings, those books are certainly all in those genres. I mean, if you think about Star Wars, for example, or even, you know, the Indiana Jones adventures. I mean, just think of kids sitting in a movie theater on a Saturday. I mean, just going back to my childhood, you know, and looking at those stories. Those are kids' stories, but they're so well done that it doesn't matter what age you are, you can enjoy them. And that, you know, there's a lot of middle. I enjoy the middle grade books that I read. I don't just read them for my career. I read them because I enjoy them, and I love seeing how other authors approach certain subjects. Another thing, you know, just that I was thinking also is that there's stories about kids of different faiths, you know, different religions, who come from different cultures, and this is going back a little bit to what we were talking about before. But there's really just such a wide range of stories and kids and types of situations that, you know, if you don't like one book, if a kid doesn't like one book, you know, they can try another. And, you know, with the internet, there's so many ways of exploring books, whether they're banned in your local community or not. You know, that doesn't really, I mean, of course it stops kids who don't have access, but, you know, I mean, if you're, you know, I doubt very much that there's a lot of young people listening to this necessarily, but there's adults who can help kids get access to the books that they can read and learn something from. So, you know, banned or not.
Agreed. So let's talk about the creative process a minute. I'm a published author, and I thought it would take a few months to write my book on mysticism. But just getting it all out, there was so many ideas in my head, took at least a year. And then you need 6 or 8 or 10 edits on the book once the original manuscript is on paper. And I'm sure you could talk about that. Yeah, and there's developmental editors who really help shape the whole thing. And then there's other kinds of editors that are more about grammar and syntax and all that kind of thing. So let's talk about that a little.
Yeah, the biggest block to being published was when I would doubt myself, or somebody would say something that would make me think I might not be good enough. But what I discovered is that if I learned everything I could about my craft and I kept working to make it better, and I didn't take every rejection as a death knell. I mean, it was always disappointing, but if I believed in what I was doing, and I really wanted to have it be read by kids, in my case, I just had to keep going and keep learning and keep getting better. And that's why it took 20 years for Summer of Luck, from idea to getting published. I mean, that was unusual. I don't mean that everybody who writes a book takes that long. But the fact is, once I had gotten a yes for Summer of Luck and I started writing book two, it took me just a little over a year to write that book. And the third book, I was on a deadline, but it took me a year. So, you know, I got a lot better by the time I was starting my second book. I knew the basics. I didn't have to learn everything, you know, from scratch. And so I really encourage people who are interested in this case, writing, to read widely in the genre you want to write in, and get connected with other writers too, because that is the best way to learn and to progress and to get feedback on your work, so that you can see, well, you know, that really didn't, that scene didn't quite work, but this one did. And so find a way to incorporate what you have and make it better. I'm working on my fourth book right now. It's not a fantasy. It's not in the Summer of Luck series. It's a contemporary fiction about a kid who, like me, went through a lot of the things that I went through growing up. And it's a very personal book. I never thought I would write a book like this, but I am writing it. And I'm probably about two-thirds of the way through, maybe three-quarters. And I have a writer's group that we connect. And I was asking, we write together on Zoom once a week. I mean, I write more frequently than that, but I had a question for them about this chapter that I'm working on, and I wasn't sure whether this particular thing was reading well. And I asked for some input. We brainstormed with each other between the writing sessions. And what somebody said something about the fact that in the scenes, the mother was essentially being... Her character had changed too quickly. And I realized that was true. And I had to completely go in a different direction because... And once I did, and I just finished that chapter, I realized how much stronger that chapter is now, how much stronger it's telling the story. And my first reaction when they said that was, internally, of course, I can't write. I'm a failure. You know, that's always the first voice. But I've learned that voice is not to be believed. And I put it aside. And sometimes I get stuck and I can't, and I think the same thing. Oh my God, I'll never be able to write this book. But again, I put it aside. And sometimes I put it aside and I shut the computer and I don't write again until the next day. But when I open it again, I have an idea. And it's amazing where these ideas sometimes come from. Some people write where they plan the whole book out. Those are called plotters. But there's a category called pantsers, people who write by the seat of their pants.
Got it.
And that's how I write. And a lot of people write that way. Because for me, that's the joy of writing, is the story just comes out. And either way is great. You know, there's no rules. They tell you there's rules, but there's no rules.
Right.
And I mean, just look at successful books. You know, I can't think of any examples that are coming to mind, but you know, any book that is a, I mean, let's just talk about a book like The Color Purple. I mean, that book is old enough that maybe nobody remembers it, but probably people do. And you know, it was a very dark book, and the kind of book that you wouldn't necessarily think would sell, but somebody was brave enough to publish that book, and it was a big hit, and it opened the doors to other books that explored those kinds of difficult subjects.
Alice Walker.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you want to write, if you have something to say, I encourage you to do that and to keep at it and get as good as you can and get the help you need to help you get better. There's so many writing courses and coaches and all kinds of things, and you know, things that don't even cost that much, and get feedback and keep going even when you don't think that you can or that you should. You know, because there is, I do love my PR work, but I think the reason I started writing for kids when I did was because I needed some other creative outlet that I didn't have through my regular PR work. And I find that still today. I still work. I still have my day job, as I call it, which I love. And I really appreciate the opportunity to do the kind of work that I do and enjoy it. But my joy is my book writing. And I do it almost every night. When the pandemic started and I wasn't going anywhere, you know, I had all this time to write, and I've kept up that habit. And I write every evening for a couple hours. And sometimes I don't write much. Sometimes I'm not sure where I'm going next. So I play on the internet or I do a crossword puzzle or whatever, you know, but I do it. And you know, even if it's just one sentence, it's okay. So that's why I'm saying there's no rules. And you know, you make your own rules for your creative life. And I think for me, I've gotten a lot of joy out of doing it that way.
Well, I have a few amends. I think this idea of completing things is really important. I think those who succeed are those who keep going and don't give up. So just getting through it, finishing the manuscript, keep on going, this is essential. We have to just drive ourselves to that, no matter how much resistance or laziness or procrastination.
Or rejection.
The next point I want to make is that in this day and age, we really need to dig deep. We really need to find our muse. Because if we turn out mediocre product, likely it won't see the light of day. Because there's an ocean of mediocre creation. And we have to plumb the depths of our soul and come up with something that's interesting and good and creative and well-crafted. You know, people will discount it if it's not edited well. So it has to be put together very well. But with ideas and something new and interesting, something that grabs you, not the same old story. So we really have to come. It's, I mean, this is very hard on the artist and in any of the arts, because of the ocean of material out there. It's very hard on us, but in some kind of evolutionary way, it forces us to get better. We have to get very good if we're going to be seen and heard. But the last thing I want to say is, as hard as writing and putting together a book is, what's much harder is selling it. You know, it's hard to sell books. It's hard to get people to go to concerts and pay for tickets. There's so many things that we can do these days. And this is also the bane of the artist, because we just want to create our art. And, you know, we come out of our balcony, book in hand, we did it! Crickets, you know, silent, like, why isn't the world loving? You know, so this is, it's a very emotionally hard, and it's the business of it. So that's another mountain to climb. Don't worry about that when you're writing, but it is, just understand, it's a big mountain, and it's defeated many of us. But this comes back to this point I'm saying about be brilliant, because the better it is, the more chance it'll have to really find its audience and spread by word of mouth, and not try to hope for tricks or manipulation or some kind of clever marketing thing to get, you know, it just never works these days, because everybody's doing that right now. Everybody's trying to, you know, find the back door to success. And so that market is already full.
If you followed the Random House trial, where the Justice Department was suing to prevent a merger between, I think it was Random House. Yeah, it was Random House and some other publishing house. And the head of Random House said, perhaps apocryphally, if I use that word right, but he said that the publishing is so random, which is why they called it Random House. I don't believe that, but it's a good joke. But he also said, or somebody said in that trial, it came out that of all of the books published, even by big publishers like that, that most of them sell less than 100 copies, which I was shocked to hear, because I know Summer of Luck sold more than 100 copies. So I felt like, well, I must, you know, that's good. It's good to know. But the point is that there's a lot of product out there that doesn't sell. And, oh, well, that's why perseverance is so important, because, you know, do it for the joy of it. And as you say, make sure it's good. But at that point, it's sort of out of your control. So enjoy what you're doing, and don't give up, and just keep going.
Laura Stegman, Summer of Luck. Where can people find you?
LauraStegman.com is my website.
Thank you so much for coming today.
Thank you for having me. It was a great pleasure. Oh.
We are coming to the end of the Mystic Pete Chronicles. You can reach me at mysticpete.com and Mystic Pete on social media. In today's show, I interviewed Laura Stegman talking about the writer's process and her book, Summer of Luck. The music we heard before the interview was Equilibrium by Andrei Vinogradov on Hurdy Gurdy. And then we just wrapped things up with a tune by Opium Moon, Woman, Life, Freedom. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week with the best of talk radio. Mystic Pete out.